Greek voters say enough already. Today, Monday, January 26th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A left-wing anti-austerity party comes to power in Greece. The man who's set to become finance minister blames Europe for squeezing his country too hard in 2010.
What we've been having ever since is a kind of what I call fiscal waterboarding policies that have turned this nation into a debt colony.
Also today, President Obama's trip to India and his warm friendship with Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
There is a lot of bromance going on. Somebody called it a Mobama sort of thing between
a
the
Mobama
two of them.
A Mobama moment.
A Mobama moment, exactly.
And later, an underwater photographer's encounter with a sperm whale.
It basically stopped right beside us, pointed its business end at us, and unleashed for a number of minutes.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Enough. That's what Greeks are saying at the ballot box to years of punishing austerity measures. Greek voters swept the left-wing anti-austerity Syriza party into power yesterday. At the head of that party is a young politician named Alexis Tsipras.
As one of my friends emailed me this morning, he said, "Today is going to be the best day of Alexis Tsipras's life. From here on out, it's downhill."
That's an economist at Harvard we'll hear from in a moment. Let's not start heading downhill quite yet, though. First, a reality check, because Alexis Tsipras ran on the promise of renegotiating Greece's bailout agreements, which total some $240 billion. As the new prime minister told cheering crowds in Athens, Greece is leaving behind catastrophic austerity, fear, and autocratic government. Sounds pretty good, but can it really happen? Here's The World's Clark Boyd.
They're taking away our dignity. I heard it time and time again when I was in Greece for the last general election a few years back. The anger and frustration wasn't just aimed at EU bureaucrats and German bankers. It was also aimed inward at what Greeks still see as a hopelessly corrupt and ineffective political system. Alexis Tsipras and his Syriza party promised to change it all, inside and out. And judging by the election results, Greeks bought it this time around. Tsipras thanked them for their vote of confidence and asked Greeks for space to create a new future with dignity.
You defeated fear and you brought up a smile to every Greek man and woman. And I invite you forward, let us proceed on this difficult and beautiful struggle. Let us raise the sun over Greece.
Sunny wouldn't be the way to describe Greece under the Eurozone's austerity measures. Unemployment skyrocketed, small businesses failed, a third of all Greeks lost their state health insurance, young people left in droves.
Let's be frank here. In 2010, tragically, our state, Greece, became bankrupt.
That's economist Yanis Varoufakis speaking to the BBC today.
And Europe, official Europe, in its infinite wisdom, decided to deal with this bankruptcy by unloading the largest loan in human history on the weakest of shoulders, those of the Greek taxpayer, on condition that the bankrupted nation is going to have to shrink its income by a quarter. I think it takes an 8 or 9 year old to understand that this cannot end well. What we've been having ever since is a kind of what I call fiscal waterboarding policies that have turned this nation into a debt colony.
Varoufakis, himself a Syriza supporter, looks set to become Greece's new finance minister in a coalition government. Syriza didn't win an outright majority. Instead, it's partnered with a right-wing anti-austerity party called Independent Greeks. Task number one for the Syriza-led government will be to renegotiate the bailout deals with the Eurozone, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank. Across Europe, there's been the typical, "we're ready to work with the new government of Greece" kinds of statements. But that will only go so far.
We stick to our promises, but they need to stick to their promises as well.
Niels Annen is with Germany's Social Democrats, who are currently in a coalition with Chancellor Angela Merkel's party.
Our message to Mr. Tsipras will be that we should cooperate with them, but this will not mean, and this is a little bit what he offered and promised his electorate, that will not mean that the difficult structural adjustments can be avoided. We need to do both.
Doing both will be easier said than done for Alexis Tsipras. He's promised to ease the country's debt burden, to put the country on a path toward economic growth, to stimulate the economy. But for that, he needs money. And Greece's credit rating isn't exactly stellar these days. In other words, it will be hard to get loans. Guntram Wolf heads the Bruegel think tank in Brussels. He says Alexis Tsipras should expect a difficult first month in office.
He has promised really quite a lot, and at the moment, at least, I still fail to see how he can afford all of this domestically. So he's going to face at some stage reality, and that may be pretty tough for Greece.
But Yanis Varoufakis, the man who will likely be at the center of Greece's negotiations with its European counterparts, remains optimistic.
We're not going to go to Brussels and to Frankfurt and to Berlin in a confrontational style. There is plenty of room for mutual gains and benefit, and we shall endeavor to find that room.
Greece and its Eurozone partners have about a month to figure out if the rules can be bent, and if so, how much. The country's latest bailout extension expires at the end of February. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd.
We just heard the previous austerity policies in Greece described as fiscal waterboarding. Some might simply call them fiscal responsibility. Richard Parker, what do you call them?
A fiscal challenge.
Okay. Richard Parker, an economist at Harvard, he was an advisor to a previous Greek government. If Tsipras is the antidote to the bailout regimes, then is his answer not paying back loans? I mean, ultimately, he's got to find some revenue somewhere, right?
Well, several things. You can restructure these loans in dozens of different ways, and the question of whether you absolutely write off the principle is an open one. He clearly is going to push in that direction and is going to want these government and semi-government agencies like the ECB and the IMF to absorb some of these losses. Now, in the context of Europe, it would be a wise thing to get past this Greek crisis rather than keep scratching at it and let it infect other European countries like Spain or Portugal or, worst of all, Italy. Greece is a small economy in Europe, about 2% of the European economy. And for all those reasons, finding a way to steadily cut down the amount of money the Greeks are going to have to pay back is a wise move.
Let's say Syriza is kind of angling for a forgiveness-type policy. If that does happen, what's to stop, you know, Spain and maybe Italy or Portugal if they get into deep trouble?
So that's the moral – yeah, sure. That's the moral hazard argument. You know, it's always trotted out. It was trotted out in 2008 here. And the fact of the matter is, once you've gone through sort of ventilating about moral hazard, you get back to the fundamental business of – getting these economies going again. You have to understand that the Greek debt of 2010 was primarily owned to privately owned banks across Europe. And the reason that the European governments were willing to lend to the Greeks was not to let that money go to Athens and then stimulate the Greek economy. It didn't. The money would be shipped to Athens, and metaphorically, within 24 hours, that money was being shipped back to German, French, Swiss, Italian, English banks who had previously bought Greek bonds. What was happening was the Europeans were recapitalizing their banks, but saying that what they were doing was rescuing Greece.
Let me ask you this. I mean, Syriza seemed to find success in the Greek elections by telling voters that no one's going to tell us what to do in Greece. But at the end of the day, won't Greece have to accept that they can't just go their own way?
It's been that, look, this is a Mediterranean culture in which bravura and braggadocio are historically large elements of the way that the culture is communicated. When I was advising Prime Minister Papandreou, we were carefully watching polls of Greek public opinion. And the number of Greeks who wanted to stay in the Eurozone never fell below 75% of the population. And recent polls indicate that the same is true. So there's an anger about being pushed around, but there's no desire to leave the neighborhood, if you will.
Well, today, it's kind of funny. The markets seem to be taking the news in stride, the news from Greece about the elections. How come?
Well, that's a straightforward thing, which is if the money that Greece owes is owed to Deutsche Bank, a private bank, and it's a lot of money and Greece defaults on it, then the bank is potentially at risk of collapsing. But this money is primarily owed to the IMF, the ECB, and European governments, none of which is at risk at all of collapsing. So the indebtedness of the Greeks has been removed from the private money market and transferred over to state entities. That's why the markets are not particularly flummoxed by, you know, Greek talk of taking a hike on the debt.
So not too much risk to the U.S. here?
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, the risk is a continued non-growth or even deflation in Europe. Europe is collectively America's biggest trading partner. And you want your partner recovering if, in fact, you want to sustain your own recovery. Something like a 30% of U.S. GDP is now tied up in international trade. And you do not want to be trying to sell American goods abroad into entire continents where the economies are shrinking.
Richard Parker at Harvard's Kennedy School, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
Another piece of news out of Greece. The famous Greek rock singer Demis Roussos died yesterday at the age of 68. Roussos was popular during the 70s and 80s with a string of hits, like this tune he performed with his band Aphrodite's Child. Roussos was known for his high-pitched voice and for wearing colorful kaftans on stage. Roussos was half Greek, but was born and raised in Egypt. Lamprini Thoma is a documentary writer and a producer. So help us understand who Demis Roussos was. A progressive rocker, but he also had this reputation as a heartthrob. Can you be both?
He was the heart of the European 70s, I think, in a way, which were a little different than the American 70s. He was everything, but not in a big sense. He was not a songwriter. He was not a composer. He was just a performer. He was a very sweet person. He had a wonderful life, full of women, drink, traveling, singing. But he was not as big as other names that we produced. He didn't manage to get out of his era in a way.
In 1985, he happened to be on TWA flight 847, going from Athens to Rome. What happened?
There was a hijack at the TWA flight, which was going from Athens to Rome. There were some Greeks inside, and among them was Demis Roussos. It was a Hezbollah hijacking. And the Greek government decided to free one of the Palestinian fighters in exchange for getting those Greeks free. Demis Roussos was among them. He never spoke a lot about it. It wasn't a big part of interviews that he gave later.
Right. Was this one of those moments where it was kind of good news? Greece seems to have triumphed over its tough creditors in Europe with the elections yesterday, but then bad news, this icon, Demis Roussos, dies. How did that news affect Greeks?
It didn't take the toll that it should have because of the political situation now. I mean, if it was another time, it could be more bigger news than what it is now.
How did it affect you, Lamprini?
Me, personally?
Yeah.
Well, I have a radio show, so I played a song of him. I'm in my 50s. He's part of my youth, my childhood. And I don't know, though, if I will remember him a week from now, to be honest.
Really? Why not?
Because he was not one of those persons that modify your sense of music. He was an entertainer. He was not Bob Dylan.
Well, Lamprini, let's remember Demis Roussos properly today. Tell us what song you played on your radio program.
I played one of his French songs. It's Quand je t'aime.
Quand je t'aime, when I love you. Great sentiment.
I think it's one of his most beautiful songs.
Lamprini Thoma, a documentary writer and producer, speaking with us from Athens. Thank you very much for talking about Demis Roussos today.
Thank you. Quand je t'aime, j'ai l'impression d'être un roi, un chevalier d'autrefois, le seul homme sur la terre. Quand je t'aime, j'ai l'impression d'être à toi, comme la rivière.
Later on The World, squids have ink, sperm whales have... not here, not now. Stick around and I'll tell you more on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. President Obama is out of town, and he's missing a few things at home, starting with the blizzard that's freaking out everyone from Washington to here in Boston. The president spent the day in India as a guest of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. It was India's national holiday, Republic Day. Sanjeev Miglani has been following the events in India for Thomson Reuters.
There is quite a buzz here about Obama as well as Modi. I mean, Indians have always looked up to America. So an American visitor for the first time on a Republic Day parade in 66 years is quite an event.
If you pull Indians aside and, you know, push the pomp and circumstance out of the way, what do they think of Obama? Are there strong opinions, pro or con?
Very strong pro Obama. In this part of the world, Obama remains a leader who represents change in just the way they look at Modi as a, you know, as a force of change. So he represents that force of change in just the way they look at Obama. And I think there seems to be a natural connect. Indians tend to sort of feel naturally comfortable with the Americans. I mean, people always, there is always one member of the family who's in the States. You know, there's back and forth.
Have there been real substantive developments in the last 24 hours since Obama's arrival there that shows that Modi and Obama together equals kind of like double change?
Yeah, there is a lot of bromance going on. This is Mobama. Somebody called it a Mobama sort of thing between the two of them.
A Mobama moment.
a Mobama moment, exactly. But there is substance to some extent. I mean,
like where? Where have you seen it?
Yeah, good question. So they did a nuclear deal back in 2008, and it got frozen because of India's liability laws. No big American firm could come and, you know, set up reactors here. Now they've kind of found a way through it. So that's the one big test. The other is defense. They have made advances in defense. They want to build co-produce stuff in India. India wants to do that. And slowly, America is kind of starting to supplant the Russians in, as the source of sort of from where India imports arms. Slowly, Russia is sort of starting to slip away. Yeah.
So nuclear cooperation and defense back on track between the U.S. and India. I suspect even one of those would make China and Pakistan stand up and pay attention. Why is the India U.S. relationship important at this point in time, would you say?
So as part of President Obama's pivot to Asia, India looks like a power that can, to some extent, be the swing force here.
What are people there thinking about Obama's early departure to Saudi Arabia to pay his respects to the late King Abdullah? How's that being seen in India?
I think there might have been a slight tinge of disappointment. He didn't go to Agra. That would have, again, made for great television, great imagery.
The sight of the Taj Mahal.
The sight of the Taj Mahal, the First Lady and him in a completely enclosed place. But I guess, I mean, there is also, I mean, Indians are quite sensitive. There's been a death and you don't question that sort of thing. So I think it's not being made so much of it. But yeah, there is just a slight sense of disappointment.
Let me just ask you about two sidebars. Modi's hat collection, which apparently is just very big, and Obama's gum chewing. I don't know if he's chewing Nicorette, but are people annoyed that the president of the United States is smacking his lips as he tours all this stuff?
It's a long parade. It's 2 hours. you know, it's a very old kind of, it's an old custom. It's a Soviet-style parade combined with this cultural extravaganza like a Macy's. So it's a bit of a match and miss. So, I mean, I don't think there's too much of noise about that. As far as Modi's hat collection is concerned, yeah, Modi is quite a dresser. I mean, I think on the day Obama arrived, he changed his costume 3 times. Between those meetings, back-to-back meetings, he found time to change his wardrobe. So, yeah, his imagery is very important to him.
Sanjeev Miglani with Thomson Reuters speaking with me from Delhi. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
As we just mentioned, President Obama decided to cut short his India trip to make a stop in Saudi Arabia after the death last week of King Abdullah. The U.S.-Saudi relationship is a key part of U.S. policy in the Middle East, and thousands of Saudi students study in the U.S. each year. I spoke with two of them earlier today. Hassan Zakari is a Saudi-American student at Marymount University in Virginia. Saudi King Salman is going to presumably carry on the path set by the late King Abdullah. How's this affecting you?
Well, honestly, we're looking forward to the new king, King Salman. And, you know, he himself has a Twitter page. He plays and tells his nation hopefully that I will be able to, advance my country and my people. So we look forward to it.
Saudi Arabia has one of the worst human rights records in the world. What's been discussed among young Saudis in the United States about what King Salman might be able to do to change things?
Obviously we have, a bad representation towards the world and overall about how the strictness of Saudi Arabia. However, there are a lot of things that have been developing, little by little. What people need to understand is the religion is the rule of the law. So some things will take a little bit longer to change. However, last time I visited, which is during winter break, there have been a lot of improvements. Women now, because of King Abdullah, are able to vote and run for political office in the Saudi Congress. So we are advancing in that field.
So many Saudis seem comfortable saying that change in Saudi Arabia comes slowly. Yeah. Doesn't anyone there want change to come quickly?
Of course, there are going to be those who are going to be wanting to change to be quickly, especially those who, live outside and then come back and be like, why can't we do this? Why can't we do this? Which is, it's understandable. However, us being religious and, true to Islam gives us the patience. As long as we're seeing the development coming slowly, then we're comfortable with that. We know we don't see much of a trouble because it's coming sooner or later.
Hassan Zakari at Marymount University in Virginia. Thanks for speaking with me.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you for having me.
Let me turn now to another student, Kaloub Mashref. She's also a student from Saudi Arabia at Marymount. She studies biology. What did you appreciate about King Abdullah, besides the fact that he funded a program for students to study abroad? I'm sure you benefited some from that.
For me, besides the getting here on a scholarship and continuing my education here, he really appreciate the woman role in Saudi Arabia, that he opened a new first only women university. It's called the University of Princess Noura. Girls like me who didn't get the chance to go to any university, they have the chance to go there.
Yeah, so you can go now to an all-women's university in Saudi Arabia, but you still can't drive.
Well, drive is not an issue. We own our own drivers back home. We give them money. It's a good paying job. It's not really a big deal. We can go with a driver anywhere we want.
Does it not bother you that Saudi Arabia says women can't drive?
It doesn't bother me a lot. No, it's not. It doesn't bother me at all.
Doesn't bother you at all, or it doesn't bother you a lot?
I'm sorry. It doesn't bother me at all because, I don't drive. I'm a 24-year-old girl that cannot drive, and I'm going to learn how to drive because I'm going to go to medical school and it requires me to have a car to just get me from point A to point B. Hmm. That's it. But back in Saudi Arabia, there's a designated driver that we pay monthly. So there is no need for us to drive there.
I mean, a lot of people look at the law that prohibits women from driving in Saudi Arabia as kind of fitting into a lot of other deplorable human rights things on Saudi Arabia's books. You don't see it that way?
No, not really. Because in my perspective, if women going to drive in Saudi Arabia, it's going to be one big disaster.
So what would you like to see the new king, King Salman, do that would make your life, your future life as a doctor in Saudi Arabia easier?
I'm hoping that he will continue what King Abdullah started, allow some rules and some new technology into Saudi Arabia to improve our skills and hopefully develop Saudi Arabia.
Kaloub Mashref, a biology major at Marymount University in Virginia. Good luck with your driving lessons.
Thank you.
News headlines are up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, a photographer takes maximum advantage of an underwater encounter with a sperm whale and its bodily functions.
Well, how often are you going to find yourself in a sperm whale punado? So I took the opportunity to get as many photos as I could from both inside and outside of the poo ball.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Everyday people are killed all around the world, but we don't hear much about most of them. Today, though, I want to tell you about one of them. This weekend, a woman named Shaima Al-Sabag went to a protest in Cairo. One minute, she's helping to hold a banner. The next, this. Ms. Sabag and others were marking the fourth anniversary of the protest at Tahrir Square that led to the ouster of Hosni Mubarak, and they were met with gunfire. At least 17 people were killed, including Sabag. Her shooting was actually caught on video. I spoke with Borzu Daragahi. He's the Mideast and North Africa correspondent for the Financial Times. He's based in Cairo. I got to say, this video has sad echoes of 2009 in Iran of the protester, a 23-year-old Neda Sultan, who was shot during protests there. A female face in the crowd apparently eliminated by a gun. What do we know about what happened to Shaima al-Sabag?
Well, I mean, there's differing accounts, but nearest I can tell from piecing together accounts from people who were there, people who were nearby from the video and so on, is that there was a small protest gathering in Talat Harb, that's a square in central Cairo. They were heading to the iconic Tahrir Square to lay a commemorative wreath in honor of the people who were killed in Egypt's 2011 uprising. Suddenly, police armed with tear gas and buckshot, it appears, stormed the small crowd and, according to many witnesses, opened fire with both tear gas and buckshot. And, the autopsy reports are not in yet. They're not conclusive yet. But some of this buckshot apparently struck this woman, Shaima Sabag, a woman in her early 30s, a mother, married originally from Alexandria, activist co-founder of a leftist socialist party that ironically supported the 2013 coup that put Sisi in power, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, now president of Egypt. And based on the video that we saw, she basically either had some kind of severe brain trauma and died shortly after this incident or succumbed to other wounds.
She has been described as a poet. Was she well known?
She was not well known. She was kind of well known within certain activist circles, especially among those who are from Alexandria, which is where she is originally from. But she was not like one of the most well-known figures in the activist universe.
I'm just curious, Borzu, Egyptians who are angered and saddened by the death of Shaima al-Sabag, who are they blaming for that? Who are they angry with?
They're definitely angry at the security forces. They're angry at the government. Interestingly, and strangely, and perhaps a sign of hope and a glimmer of a crack within the elite, there was a front page piece in the state-owned newspaper, Al Ahram, which was very critical of this killing and laid the blame squarely with President Sisi.
So I gather Hosni Mubarak's sons have been released from jail. Of course, this is also many moments of anniversary of the 2011 Tahrir Square protests. Can you kind of put Shaima's death and these other moments into kind of context on what they tell us about the state of Egypt right now in 2015?
Right now, at least, we're in a situation where the old guard under Mubarak is on the offensive and reestablished itself. There are a couple theories as to why the judiciary decided to release the sons of Hosni Mubarak on the eve of the anniversary or right around the time of the anniversary. But, you know, one of the things that I've heard is that it's sort of intra-elite politics, an attempt by Sisi's clique and the people who are in charge now to make peace with those who were ousted under Mubarak and to create sort of a unity among these old elites. So you see an attempt really on the part of those old figures in the regime to really reestablish themselves and to put themselves, entrench themselves in power in a way that they cannot be removed anytime soon or easily.
Yeah, so if that's the case, what's the mood among Egyptians? Because that's not what they really wanted with the 2011 revolution.
Well, Egyptians are 90 million people, and there's a lot of different people, a lot of different ideas, a lot of views. But I think a lot of people actually do want this. A lot of people were so alienated by the excesses and the chaos and the turmoil and the economic downturn of the years following the revolution that they are really in the mood for someone to come in with an iron fist and a big black military boot and to stamp down on dissent, to stamp down on people who question the current order. They want stability above all else. And if that means sacrificing these high-minded notions of freedom and democracy, then so be it.
Borzu Daragahi, correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks for telling us about Shaima Al-Sabag. Appreciate it, Borzu.
It's my pleasure.
It's also been a crazy time in Yemen. Last week, the president, Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi, was ousted as Houthi rebels took control of the capital, Sana'a. And today come reports of a U.S. drone strike targeting al-Qaeda militants in eastern Yemen. Ibrahim al-Hajibi has been watching the chaos in his country from his new home. He lives in Minnesota, where he studies at Augsburg College.
I first came to the United States in 2007 as an exchange student. And I just really loved it. I lived in Cloquet, Minnesota, a very small town up north, where the only thing that we had was a Walmart. So we would go Walmarting in, for fun.
That was your entertainment.
My high school friends, yeah. So then I decided to come back to Minnesota. I really liked the people, liked the culture.
Couldn't stay away from Walmart.
Yeah.
What's it been like watching things unfold in Yemen from Minnesota right now? How does it feel?
Yeah, it's very sad and disheartening to see my country going through all this violence and instability while being thousands of miles away. You know, as I said, I left my home country in 2007. But then after a year, I went back to Yemen and everything was pretty stable. Then when I left again for college, I left months before the Arab Spring erupted. So I just barely missed the revolution, and many of my friends lost their lives peacefully protesting for democracy and freedom. So at the beginning, yes, I felt helpless, you know, being oceans away from history making in my country.
Did the people in the Midwest, when you first got to Minnesota back in 2007, did young Americans know anything about Yemen?
Some people knew and some people really did not have any idea. They didn't know if Yemen was a country. So I would explain, I say Yemen is in, you know, the Arabian Peninsula. It's south of Saudi Arabia. And they're like, oh, yeah, okay.
What did people who knew Yemen a bit, what would they ask you about? Like Osama bin Laden or the bombing of the USS Cole in 2000?
Yes. So it's sad to hear things like this because Yemen has a lot more than that. Yemen is, in my opinion, one of the most beautiful countries. We have an island called Socotra that has animals and plants that are found nowhere else in the world. It's very beautiful. But now we only hear terrorism coming out of Yemen. Yemen has a lot of issue, a lot of competing factions, as we all know. We have the Houthi rebellion in the north. We have the secessionist movement in the south. And we got also AQAP, the most active branch of Al-Qaeda. And besides the fact that we also have a drug problem, we have GATT. GATT is a narcotic that about 75% of adult males consume. And also about 15 to 20% of children under 12 also consume. So it's we have a lot of socioeconomic problems besides the instability going on, which makes Yemen a safe haven for groups like Al-Qaeda and its affiliates.
I gather, Ibrahim, you became kind of politically active on campus at Augsburg College in Minnesota. What prompted that?
I left Yemen in December 2010, and then months later, the Arab Spring erupted. So I felt like I was disconnected from history making. So I wanted to do something here in the United States, especially in my college. But at the beginning, I was hesitant because whatever I was going to do was going to affect my family back home. And I still had my family back in Sana'a. So I was really a little bit hesitant, and then I connected with my host family in Minnesota, and they said, we'll support you and encourage you. And then I did a 24-hour protest where even the president of the college came out with me and peacefully protested the violations against young people in Yemen and elsewhere in the Middle East.
Now, we've heard today that the Houthi takeover and dismissal of President Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi, we've heard from some activists in Yemen that all of this just dashes their hope for a democracy there. Do you share those concerns?
I certainly do. The Houthis are now the de facto authority in Yemen, and they took it by force. They forced now former President Hadi out of his position and really are undermining the process initiated by the National Dialogue, which is, you know, creating a constitution and having elections. So they are really undermining democracy in my country. And it's really tough, you know, all that process that has gone through the Arab Spring and all these sacrifices of young people are seeing them are, you know, going in vain.
So how do you, Ibrahim, how do you deal with that from thousands of miles away in Minnesota?
I've been doing an ongoing research about drones and drone policy and how drones have contributed to the problem in Yemen and how it has created a lot of terrorists. Many analysts have said that now drone attacks have been a tool of choice for al-Qaeda recruiting. So al-Qaeda goes to these communities that have been affected by drones and try to recruit from that. I'm not totally against drones. I am with better use of drones and more intelligence in the ground.
Yemeni-born Ibrahim al-Hajibi, speaking with me from his home in Minnesota. Great to meet you, and thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All the talk here in Boston today is about the coming snowstorm, but our next story is about a different kind of storm. It's about, well, for lack of a better word, it's a poop storm. Kerry Wilk is an underwater photographer based in Toronto. Last year, he captured some incredible images of a sperm whale while he was diving off the coast of Dominica. Then, Kerry, something happened when you approached the sperm whale. Tell us what.
The whale actually came up to us, stopped, and unleashed a what's being called a poonado or poopnado on us. It basically stopped right beside us, pointed its business end at us, and unleashed for a number of minutes. And after it unleashed its bowel movement, it proceeded to bob up and down in the water, splash its tail around, and basically make the poo ball as large as it could to hide itself. And then it burst out of the ball into the depths once it was finished.
So you said it defecated for several minutes. What was that like? I mean, what did you see?
At first, it was sort of normal, because sperm whales, whenever sperm whales dive, or even just as they're passing by you, it's actually quite common to see sperm whales defecate like this. Well, not like this, but you can see them defecating. This time it was just on a whole, you know, several orders of magnitude larger than a normal, you know, defecation event. It would just come out in bursts, burst after burst after burst. It just didn't really seem to have an end. And then at one point, when the poo cloud was large enough, you could no longer see the whale. It was completely obscured within the poo cloud. Who knows what was going on inside there, if he was doing more, or if he was just waiting for the cloud to spread, but...
And yet, despite all of this, the natural response would be to get away from this cloud of poop, but you stayed and photographed it.
Well, how often are you going to find yourself in a sperm whale poonado? So I took the opportunity to get as many photos as I could from both inside and outside of the poo ball, despite the fact that the result was getting the matter all over, you know, our hair, inside of our wetsuits, on our faces, some went in our mouths.
I have to ask you, does it smell underwater? I mean,
well,
is
underwater,
that impossible?
You know, underwater, it doesn't smell, but on the surface, I did take a moment to take my mask off to get a whiff of the event, and sure enough, it is very pungent, actually.
Why do you think whales do this? I mean, you were too close to them, and they reacted?
It's being speculated that this is actually a defense mechanism that the whale was using in order to... Well, very similar to how an octopus or squid or any cephalopod might release ink toward a predator in order to confuse or distract it while it tries to get away.
I suspect next time you see a sperm whale, you'll be a little more careful.
Yeah, well, you know, as strange and gross and disgusting as the event actually was, I really actually do feel sort of privileged to have been able to encounter this. So a lot of people are asking or saying, you know, oh man, that must have been terrible. But really, when I look back at it and I look at the photos, it was actually a really wonderful sort of experience.
Well, the photos are phenomenal. I mean, despite what we see going on there, they are incredible. And we've got them at PRI.org, the calm before the storm and then the poop storm itself. Again, PRI.org. And Kerry Wilk, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Before we take a short break, we want to note the death of the great Indian cartoonist, R.K. Lakshman. He died today at the age of 93. He was famous for his daily pictures in the Times of India, depicting the so-called common man. Ritu Kanduri has written a lot about Indian cartoons, and here's how she described Lakshman's work.
His cartoons were a snapshot of the most important event of the day, and it summarized, without necessarily taking sides, what the burning issue was, whether it was a domestic national issue or international. Lakshman would capture it with his brushstrokes in a way that was captivating and that allowed you to then navigate the finer details of the news through the prose of the newspaper.
Ritu Kanduri spoke with my colleague Carol Hills late last year. You can hear that interview and see a selection of R.K. Lakshman's cartoons at PRI.org. This is The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. The word today is that Kurdish fighters have expelled ISIS extremists from Kobani. Kobani is the Syrian border town that they've been fighting over for 4 months. ISIS has attracted thousands of foreign fighters to its cause, but the anti-ISIS movement is getting a few as well, including some from the U.S. Rebecca Collard recently met with a surfer from Florida named Dean Parker, who joined the fight against ISIS in northern Iraq.
Dean Parker was sitting on his couch one evening after a long day as a commercial painter. He saw a news report about Kurds fighting on Mount Sinjar. Thousands of Yazidis were trapped there by ISIS.
I made the decision right there after watching those news reports and watching it for an hour. I was very upset, and I was still watching the news, and I was online booking a ticket.
He packed body armor from a local army surplus shop, a pair of sturdy boots, clothes, and his e-reader, loaded with a copy of Sun Tzu's The Art of War. A month later, Parker was in Syria, fighting with Kurdish forces on the front line with ISIS.
Bullet going past your head makes a very interesting sound.
Tall and lanky, the 49-year-old, an avid surfer and grandfather, had no military experience. And he didn't tell his family his plan until he arrived in Syria.
At first, they were very worried, you know, messaging me, you know, just come home, come home, come home. And I'm like, sorry, you know, I can't, you know, not yet anyways. And then after a couple of days, you know, it sunk in, and then, you know, they were very supportive.
He was kept off the most active front lines, but that's not the case for many of the other Western fighters who have joined Kurdish forces. This video shows Canadian veteran Dylan Hillier under fire with Kurdish Peshmerga forces. He tries to help an injured fighter. Hillier served in Afghanistan with the Canadian military.
Tommy's gonna be all right.
Parker says he met two other Americans among the dozen or so Western fighters. Sometimes they had a translator with them, but he says they always found ways to communicate. Parker recalls the first time his unit came under fire. He was on guard duty on the roof.
I go running back and I yell over the side of the wall down to some of the other foreign fighters like, hey guys, I'm getting shot at up here. What should I do? And they looked up at me and they all started laughing. And one of them said, I think ducking would probably be a good idea. And I started laughing. I'm like, okay, I'll do that.
There's a general camaraderie among the Western recruits. But Parker says some of the other foreign fighters criticized him for being in a combat zone without military experience, saying it put others at risk.
It was just one or two that were kind of vibing me out about it. But everybody else I was with were like, you know, dude, we're down. Let's go. Let's go rock and roll. You know, you want on patrol? Yeah, let's go. Come on. Let's go do a patrol.
But Parker says just the presence of foreign fighters was a morale boost for the Syrian Kurdish troops.
There's a famous Kurdish saying, we have no friends but the mountains. And that saying has always stuck with me for whatever reason. And I thought, you know, myself coming, that if I do nothing else, it would be someone coming all the way around the world saying, hey, you know, you guys aren't alone in this horrific fight here against these monsters. You know, people do care. And so just the moral support.
And there seems to be plenty of morale here. This video shows a foreign fighter dancing alongside Kurdish soldiers after they opened a corridor to Mount Sinjar in December. He clumsily tries to mimic their traditional Kurdish dance as the men move arm in arm in a line. For Parker, morale is a bit lower these days. He's staying in a modest hotel in Sulaymaniyah, the Kurdish part of Iraq. He's trying to raise enough money to get a plane ticket home to Miami.
I'm sure, you know, the Department of Homeland Security is going to have a, you know, talk with me. The FBI is going to want to have a talk with me, but that's totally, you know, understandable. And, you know, I don't have anything to hide, you know. And so, yeah, I'm sure we'll have a 5 or 6 hour chit chat when I get to the airport.
For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Sulaymaniyah, Iraq.
Here's someone else you would not exactly peg to end up in Syria.
Punk rock is ethic and attitude, not a look or a style.
Jason Hammaker is a drummer from Washington, D.C., a punk rocker, not the kind you'd imagine.
Like, I don't have a mohawk. I've got, right now I'm in a Banana Republic button-up shirt. I wear it all the time. But we're interested in things that happen around the world and exploring new sounds and exploring what other people are listening to.
Even going to Aleppo, Syria to record these Sufi singers.
Allah. Allah.
Jason Hammaker made his recordings on multiple trips to Syria between 2006 and 2010. Now remember, this was before the uprising and the war there, and you could go to Syria to try to locate obscure musicians.
I was sitting in the lobby of my hotel, complaining to a friend of mine who is one of Aleppo's emerging violin players how I can't get into anything. And I was like, man, do you have any idea where I could record real Sufi music? And he started laughing. He's like, do you know who my grandfather was? I've ever told you that? I said, no. It's like, my grandfather was the head sheikh of the most influential Sufi order in Aleppo. Mm. And this specific Sufi order has produced some of the most famous Middle Eastern singers in history.
As is often the case, it's who you know. Soon, Hammaker found himself recording musicians never before heard or seen by Westerners in the courtyard of a 500-year-old house in the old city of Aleppo. But right now, with the country off-limits for Jason for security reasons, he's just trying to preserve the forgotten songs of Aleppo. Have you gone back? Have you stayed in touch with some of those singers?
I stay in touch with almost everyone that I know from Syria, but I've not returned.
So what have they told you about the situation in Aleppo? Like, we know the city has been seriously destroyed. What of, you know, that church where you once recorded? Is it still standing?
A lot of the places are standing. It's not like a nuclear bomb has gone off and leveled the entire place. You know, my interpreter that was with me for a lot of these adventures, I mean, he just went to a wedding in Aleppo a couple days ago, Jacob. Life still goes on. A lot of the places are destroyed. But people are still living there. I mean, it's an amazing resiliency. It's kind of a testament to the Syrian people, even in the refugee camps. Like, Syrians are a very resilient people and pick up the pieces and keep moving no matter what's going on. So hopefully everything ends sometime soon.
At the moment, it doesn't look like the civil war in Syria will end anytime soon. But these chants are of a moment in time and place when there was peace in Syria. That's all for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in a very snowy Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More at skoll.org. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. By the Ford Foundation, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.